We are in Exodus chapter 20, and we are on the sixth commandment. Exodus 20 and verse number 13 is where we are. Exodus 20 and verse number 13. Thou shalt not kill. You shall not murder. Or someone has translated it, you shall do no murder. We have said in this message that this is intentional killing, and also it covers unintentional killing. And especially last Sunday night, we talked about people who die for carelessness because of the carelessness of others. If you build a flat-roofed house, it makes sense that you put something around your house to keep people from falling off the edge and killing themselves. When we build an automobile, they expect us to put reasonable safety measures built into the car. And as technology improves, you have more safety involved in the cars that you drive. The improvement in automobiles is dramatic. So the matter of taking life, this is an issue that belongs to God. It belongs to God alone. In the Old Testament, if you killed someone unintentionally, there was a city of refuge to which you could flee, and in which there would be a trial. And if it was determined, for instance, if you were swinging an axe, you were chopping wood, and the axe head came loose, and it hit somebody and killed somebody, hit somebody on the head and killed him. Now, that was not intentional. You did not determine to do that. There was no forethought. There was no malice, nothing involved. It was an accident. But you were involved in it. You were involved in destroying a person's life, even though you unintentionally didn't do it. And we've said, I guess, the illustration that would be most common among us is you're driving down the road and somebody steps right out in front of your car. Nothing you can do about it. Absolutely nothing. You didn't intend. You don't know the person. There's no reason that you want the person dead. You want them alive. You don't want to hit them, but you can't stop. And you kill somebody. That's an awful thing. It's an awful thing. And God does not count that murder in the same way that he counts the malicious taking of a life. But on the other hand, we are responsible for our actions. And this commandment, you shall not murder, says you are not to run somebody over and kill them. You should not do that. Now, again, there are provisions in the Word of God that indicate that God recognizes that you didn't mean to do it. However, a life was destroyed. This thing is irreversible. There isn't anything you can do about it. So we want to talk tonight about the matter of euthanasia. And I want to share some notes that I got from the Master Seminary Journal. It's a theological journal. Just want to share some thoughts with you tonight about the matter of euthanasia. Now, abortion has been a hot topic in the discussion of the budget in Washington, D.C. It's been a very hot topic. And you have a very, what do I want to say? This would take one or two or three sermons to cover the subject of abortion. But may I say, life does begin at conception. And genetically, we know that everything that will ever develop in that child, in his personality, in his life, in his physical makeup, everything is present at conception. Nothing is missing. Nothing is ever added except nourishment from that point on. That life is a complete life at the moment of conception. Okay? And so now God has ordained there are miscarriages, there are things that happen that are natural that God has ordained should take place. And those kinds of things are lost. That is not in the category of an abortion, not at all. The abortion is the willful taking of one of these lives. And this should be in the hand of God. So abortion is, in essence, covered by this commandment, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt do no murder. Abortion basically is murder. And it is morally wrong, and it violates the law and the commandment of God. Now, on the issue of euthanasia, do you all know what that word means? I think we have some children here, some young people. And so for the sake of children, let me say that euthanasia, you, that word E-U, when you see that on the beginning of a word, that's a Greek. That is a Greek syllable and it a prefix, and what it means is well. So it means you take somebody's life with what you would think is a good purpose. In other words, you terminate somebody's life because you think it's justified and it's good. Let me back up for just one moment. There are two things in the Word of God, and it'll be covered in my notes. Two things in the Word of God where you take life at God's command. One is in war. In war, it's not murder when someone is killed. It is a matter of war. And it's not a matter of murder if you take someone's life in self-defense. And it's not a matter of murder or killing if you, according to God's commandment, take the life of a murderer. Those three things are not regarded as murder or as killing, okay? So those three things do not come under this. Euthanasia, however, is usually applied to people that are terminally ill or in great pain or at the end of what we would call their useful life. And we determine, in order to do something good, we will take their life in advance of when God would have taken their life. In other words, it is a decision that men make, which places their wisdom above God's wisdom in the case of these people. So euthanasia is done by injecting certain things that cause the heart to stop or certain things that cause life processes to stop. There are ways that one can, or giving overdoses of medication, certain kinds of medication and overdosages will kill someone. You that are in the medical field would be better at explaining this than I would. But there are ways that you can take someone's life before they are really physically ready to die. Euthanasia, meaning for what you would deem a good purpose, terminating somebody's life sooner than normal, natural processes of life would have terminated that life. And so this is an issue in society today. There are some countries where euthanasia is legal. And there have been debates in the state of California, I believe in the states of Oregon and Washington, probably too. May have been ballot measures up there. I'm not sure about the politics on that. But this is a burning issue in the day in which we live. Remember, and we'll see this, that God is the author of life and of death. So let me quote from the article. The question arises concerning the application of this biblical teaching from the sixth commandment to the modern euthanasia debate. In a seminal article wrestling with this question, Miller J. Erickson and Ines E. Bowers state this: we must therefore press further the question whether euthanasia should be classified as murder. Now, I hope you're alert tonight. I'm not going to go on until 10 o'clock tonight, but I hope you're alert for this part, if you will, please. We must therefore press further the question whether euthanasia should be classified as murder. Is it murder if you terminate somebody's life in advance of the natural processes? Is it? The elements in the biblical concept of murder seem to be, now alert minds here, please, seem to be intentional, premeditated, malicious, contrary to the desire of the or intention of the victim, or against someone who has done nothing deserving of capital punishment. Sounds good, doesn't it? Let's examine it. However, they reason that euthanasia would not be characterized by maliciousness. The person believes, even though they say it's not malicious, they believe they're doing an act of mercy that would be good for the person whose life they are terminating. This is the conclusion of people that believe in euthanasia. Hence, it appears that the attempt to evaluate euthanasia simply by appealing to the teaching regarding murder fails. Guidance in this matter must be found elsewhere. However, as was shown above, the prohibition of the sixth commandment encompasses accidental death also, a killing that does not have malicious intent. Therefore, euthanasia is prohibited by the sixth commandment. And I would agree with that statement. The Christian cannot be the agent in taking another person's life. The Bible explicitly condemns homicide, malicious or not, except in capital punishment, except in war and self-defense. So those are the three exceptions. So when it comes to euthanasia, We believe that it is prohibited by the sixth commandment. Now, here are some guidelines. You might want to take some notes here. You may face this issue. You have a loved one who is very ill. There is no hope of recovery. And what are you going to do? Here are some guidelines to the end of life issues. And then there are some other principles we'll go to when we get done with these. Number one, the Bible clearly asserts that God has sovereign control over both life and death. Now, do you believe that? All right. 1 Samuel 2:6, the Lord killeth and maketh alive. He bringeth down to the grave and bringeth up. Psalm 31:15, my times are in thy hands. Deliver me from the hand of mine enemies and from them that persecute me. Psalm 139:16, your eyes have seen my unformed substance, and in your book were all written the days that were ordained or appointed for me, when as yet there was not one of them. It is God who is Lord of life and death. And as the master, number two, as the master over death, the Lord declares, it is appointed for men to die once. Until the return of the Lord, each person must experience death. Death for the Christian is the gateway. I love this. Death for a Christian is the gateway into the presence of the Lord. It's the doorway by which we enter into the presence of God. And that is not a bad thing, dear people. 2 Corinthians 5:8. We are confident, I say, willing rather to be absent from the body and to be present with the Lord. In Philippians 1:21, Paul said, for me to live is Christ and to die is gain. Okay? So we are not afraid to die, but the master over death tells us it's appointed for us to die once. By the way, it's interesting, a little theological twist here. They say, well, let me ask you this. You remember Lazarus? Who is Lazarus? Remember Lazarus? John chapter 11. Jesus went to Lazarus' tomb and he'd been dead for how many days? 4 days. And one of his sisters said, Lord, he's been dead 4 days. He smells. He stinks already. He's got the smell of death. And Jesus said, take the stone away. And he said, Lazarus, come forth! Was that a resurrection? Well, he died again, didn't he? If you get resurrected, can you die again? That's the question. So if you want to get technical, and this is the way the theologians take care of that problem, they say he was resuscitated. And in the last day, he'll be resurrected. And I don't know about that. That's what the theologians say. That's how they figure their way through that one. Okay. So Lazarus was resuscitated, but he hasn't been resurrected yet. And he will be resurrected in the last day. So our Lord is the master of life and death. For the non-Christian, death is the entrance into Hades. Ultimately, it's the second death. The Bible gives truth about death that provides guidance for end-of-life decisions. Wow. This is that awesome description of what happens to people who die outside of Jesus Christ. Revelation 20, verse 13, the sea gave up the dead which were in it. Death and hell delivered up the dead which were in them. And they were judged every man according to their works, and death and hell were cast into the lake of fire. This is the second death. And whosoever was not found written in the book of life was cast into the lake of fire. So, there's no turning back after death. Your destiny is determined before death. There's no turning back. But death should be in the hands of God. Now, how many of you plan to die? I hope you have life insurance. If you can afford it, you ought to have life insurance. It's going to take some money to bury you, and you are going to be amazed at how much money it takes to bury you. So I hope you have some life insurance. And By the way, I don't know what a grave costs, but I think between $3,000 and $10,000 probably. And a funeral today will cost no less than between $15,000 and $25,000, okay? All depends on what you do and how you do it. You are into big money, even if you try to cut corners. There are ways to trim that on down. But it's big money. Death is inevitable. Everybody dies. And it doesn't matter what kind of water you drink. It doesn't matter what kind of food you eat. You will die. Everybody that eats food dies. Everybody that breathes air dies. Everybody that drinks water will die. Everybody will die someday if Jesus doesn't return first. And if He comes, then those of us who know Him will avoid, or we will evade, I should say. Not avoid, we will evade death. Death is inevitable. Solomon said in Ecclesiastes, there's a time to be born, a time to die, time to plant, time to pluck up that which is planted. Every person should make preparations for death. With the present legal climate, it is imperative that each believer have advanced medical directive. This is a practical thing. This is more a consideration. I think maybe I should talk about this to God's people. It's a very, very practical thing. They have what is called a power of attorney for health care. The state of California has legal provisions for that. You say, what in the world is that? That is a legal document that you fill out and you file with your doctor and give a copy to your best friend. You appoint somebody to make decisions for you. If you end up unconscious in the hospital and they want to know, do we let him live or do we pull the plug? What do we do to this guy? Do we put him on a machine and keep him alive for 25 years, even though he has no consciousness? What happens if something happens to you? So we all need to plan for this kind of thing. It's amazing how many people are afraid to even think of death. They will not visit the mortuary to make plans. They won't go to the cemetery to buy a cemetery plot. They will not fill out a power of attorney for health care because they are afraid of that word death. But I promise you, it doesn't matter how much you're afraid of it, you will die. And it's better for you to have your house in order so that your affairs can be taken care of. What will happen if you do not have a legal directive like this? What happens to you is totally out of your hand and out of your wishes and your family's for that matter. If you have no will and you die, the state will determine what happens to your children. Your family will have nothing to say about it legally. Now the court may appoint your children to your family, but they don't have to do that. They can do as they wish with your children. So everybody dies, everybody needs that preparation for death. This is very, very important. I have filled out a document, and by the way, you need to have three things. Write this down, folks. You need to have three things. You're going to die. There are three things you need to have to help those that are left behind. Okay? Three things. Number one, you need to have a power of attorney for your health care. Now, my power of attorney says, if there's no hope for my recovery and my physical processes are gone, pull the plug. Don't keep me here. If there's hope for recovery, and if you have means at your disposal to where I have hope for a full recovery, use everything you got. I want to live. If there's prospect that they can facilitate that. And I can have a useful life. If my mind is gone, my brain is shot, I've had a massive stroke, pull the plug. Let death do its work. That's what my directive says. Okay? And they have to do that. That's legally binding. My wife can take that document and say, now, doctor, you've got to pull the plug. This is what he said. This is a legal document. You need to have a power of attorney for your health care. And it has to do with whether they can keep you alive by putting a tube down your throat. If you people have been kept alive for years who have never had a state of consciousness by keeping a tube down their throat, feeding them, just keeping the food flowing through for years. And they've just sat there and just consumed time and space and money. I don't want to do that, see? But you need to decide that. You need to decide that. It's not hard to take care of this. You ought to do it. And you need to be in charge of what happens. Secondly, you need a power of attorney, a provision with someone you trust for your personal affairs. This is a legal power of attorney. It's called a durable power of attorney. And what happens is that if Edith and I went on a trip We were by automobile, and both of us got in an accident. And both of us were very severely injured. And we faced 6 months in the hospital recovery, and we were not, we were going to recover, but we were not able to pay our mortgage. We were not able to pay our bills. We were not able to make any decisions about our automobiles and what to do with our property and our money. This power of attorney would give someone we trust the ability to pay our bills while we're alive, to take care of our business affairs, to do whatever needed to be done in order to take care of our affairs financially. That's a durable power of attorney. You need to have that. There's the power of attorney over your physical life, what's going to happen at your care in the hospital, with the termination of your life. There's a power of attorney over your business affairs. And then thirdly, there's a will or a trust. A will or a trust as to what happens to what belongs to you. And you say, I'm not worth very much, but you may die in an accident and the settlement may create an estate, are you listening to me, of $1 million. This has happened. You don't know what you're worth. And you need to have a will that says that when I die, this is what I want to happen to my property, my money. This is where I want. If you have children, the will is most important. If something happens to you, who do you want to take care of your children? Who do you appoint to take care of them? So the courts don't decide that. You decide that. Okay? You parents listening to me? You listening to me? Okay? Death is inevitable. And you need to make plans for that. And so we don't plan on dying. At my age, I'm thinking I'm going to live to be 95. That will be fine with me if the Lord gives me strength for that. I think I can persecute saints for another 20 years and enjoy it. But we're all going to die. And we think ahead to the processes that are involved in this. By the way, our good pastor friend, I think I can share this with you because it is public knowledge. But our good pastor friend over in Antioch, Jim Osterwind, has a form of cancer, I think it is. But before they knew that he was going to come down with this cancer, someone talked him into buying a life insurance policy, $900,000 life insurance policy. And after he bought that thing, everything is in place within a year, I think. Am I right on this? I think it's within a year he is diagnosed as having a terminal disease. Now, he may live for another 10 years, but he probably will not live to a normal age, a normal longevity, I should say. And so what has happened is he's made provision. He had no idea he was going to have this need. But if the Lord takes him, he has provision for his family. It's taken care of. So it's good to do what you can. If you cannot do that, that's another thing. There are some kinds of insurance that are very reasonable in price. And so you think about these things. Death is inevitable. Secondly, go to 1 Corinthians 15. And death, secondly, is an enemy. 1 Corinthians 15:26. 1 Corinthians 15:26. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. Death is an enemy. Therefore, when the hope of recovery through medical treatment remains a possibility, the believer should take advantage of every opportunity to forestall death so that he can continue to serve the Lord. So death is an enemy. We should not welcome it. We should not look for it. Now, this is an interesting thing, very interesting to me. You and I, even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. And now, that's a graphic picture in the Hebrew language. Though I walk through the deep, narrow gorge of deepest darkness, and it's the danger of death that's pictured with that thing. Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will not fear any evil. So the believer is not to fear death. Why? Because God's in charge of it. Because it doesn't terminate our existence. It changes our locations. There's a change in location. Did I tell you about the preacher was laid up for at least 6 months in an illness and couldn't figure out why God had allowed him to be completely laid up, and he couldn't minister and preach, and he was stuck in bed. Telephone rang one night, and he picked up the thing, and the guy said, wrong number. He said, no, wrong number. He said, I've got a message for you. And he gave the guy a message about salvation. And it wasn't long till other people heard about this. And he was just sitting there in bed, ill, and just giving messages on his telephone. Everybody would call. And one guy called up one time and he said, I'm going to kill myself. Do you have a message for me? He said, I surely do. He said, when you kill yourself, you're not going to end your life. You're simply going to change locations. And in your condition, where you're going to change that location to is not where you want to go. Now, let me tell you. Death is an enemy. We should take advantage of every opportunity to forestall death. A healthy believer does not want to die, but a healthy believer does not fear dying. You got that? It's almost like an oxymoron, or things just don't seem to go together. We don't fear dying. If God takes my life right now, what's so bad about being with the Lord? Yeah? So we're not to fear dying, but on the other hand, we should not desire death. Usually, the desire of death comes to evade unpleasant situations. Yes? Why do people commit suicide? To escape from trouble of various kinds. So, death is an enemy, and we should evade it if possible, if there's any hope of recovery. And the medical treatment today goes beyond anything I dreamed would ever happen. When I began, in fact, my grandfather in 19... I think my grandfather Shattuck, my mother's dad, died... I think he saw my brother Neil. I think he died in 1938. You know what took his life? He had a burst appendix. Now, when's the last time you heard of somebody dying from an appendix bursting? Not in America, you don't. They go in, wash it out, and fill you up with antibiotics, and you're in good shape very quickly. But when my grandfather died in 1938, they did not have antibiotics. And his appendix burst, and he died from a burst appendix. And so now we have things that are just absolutely amazing, the things that can be done medically. The technology is amazing. If you wonder why health insurance costs so much, you either have to pay for this technology, or you have to do without it. I'd rather pay and have it, because it's of great, great benefit to us. They have things that can just read right. They look right through your body, soft tissue. They can see everything in there. They can look at the cellular structure in your brain. If you have a stroke, or you think you have, they can take a picture and they can know exactly what's happening where. They have ways to go into your heart now arthroscopically to fix the thing without making that big thing in your chest. I mean, the things that they can do are phenomenal. And there's more coming down the way. As it's being developed in development now, so medical. But the thing about it is that there are two things you can do with this technology. Number one, you can keep a man alive even though his mind is gone and there's no life left except a warm body. You can keep his body warm for 30 years. That's what you can do with modern technology. You can keep his body warm and going. It won't move. It won't respond. But it has life in it. You can keep that thing going for years. So there are choices that we have. And on the other hand, you can take conditions that several years ago, 10, 20 years ago, would have been the end of your life, because it would have destroyed any recovery, capacity for recovery. Now the medications, by the way, if you ever have the beginning of a heart attack or a stroke, you get to the hospital immediately, and they have medications. They have things developed now that if you catch it within 30 minutes to 3 hours, it is amazing. They can almost do away with all of the with a lot of the difficulties that come because of strokes now. But you have to get there on time. You have a heart attack the same way before the tissue is destroyed. They have drugs now that can go in there, open things up, dissolve what is in there. It is absolutely amazing what can be done. So we are, on one hand, we want to preserve our lives, but on the other hand, when the time to go is obviously there, we don't want to stay around any longer. So we got these two things going on in our thinking, see? Two different things going on in our thinking. Come back a week, 2 weeks from tonight for the fourth point. That's as far as I can go. I don't want to go late tonight. I'm 20 minutes after. And we have a big schedule coming ahead on us with these meetings coming up. And I want us to survive all of this. We need to value the life that God has given us, treasure it. We need to reverence life because God is the one who brings it into existence. God is the one who places value on life. Our life is not worth what we think it's worth. Hear me this. Don't shut your brain down quite yet. Our life is not valued. The true value of our life is not determined by what we think it is. The true value of our life is determined by what God made it to be. Yeah? And that's different than what other people think, and that's different than what we think. The true value of life is what God has made it to be, not what we think it to be. So we'll continue on. I hope this will be in a practical way helpful to you. We'll get into some of the nitty-gritty of this stuff. What is pulling the plug? Do you kill somebody when you pull the plug? Do you? You're going to have to come back for that one.